Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk program on AM 580. David Inge is away. I'm Tom Rogers. And in our first hour, we turn the phones over to you if you have questions about home maintenance and home inspections and home repair and questions of that nature. Scott Spies is our guest on this hour of Focus 580. He joins us every once in a while, joins David in the studio here to answer your questions. He is with Spies Home Inspection. And you mentioned you've got a computer out here. You've got like 8,000 homes in your database. So you've visited just about every one of them here in Champaign-Urbana at some time or another. You and your father.
Yeah. I don't know about every one of them, but quite a few houses,
You're
yes.
getting there. Maybe some multiple times, but Scott has a wealth of knowledge and a background in home maintenance and things that you should watch out for, so those things don't show up as strikes in that home inspection that he may do in the future. He'll be happy to take your calls. Our numbers in Champaign-Urbana, the local line, 333-9455. Toll-free outside the local calling area. You can call us at 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And Scott, we were just talking beforehand about some storm damage that people may see or may not see on their homes. And we've been through several storms in this area, and people ought to be looking out for stuff that may or may not be obvious. Huh?
Well, right now, obvious thing that people are looking at is water in the basement.
Yeah.
The other thing we need to look at that's not so obvious, we need to look up because there's been an awful lot of wind, an awful lot of tree damage, things like that. It's not a bad idea to go out and take a walk around the house, look at the shingles, look at the siding, make sure we don't have some loose soffit pieces, make sure we don't have some missing shingle tabs, any major tree branches down on top of the roof, all sorts of little things to look at. So, yeah, after we've had a couple of these storms, the maintenance around the exterior of the house becomes a little bit more important.
Yeah, there may be things that are loose that may not be visible right off the bat, but maybe a little closer look would catch some of the things before they become problems in the long term.
And that's correct. We can stop or spot a potential leak or problem in a roof. So,
let's get right to our calls, and we've got one on line 4 in Lafayette, Indiana. Good morning.
Good morning. You, a month or so ago, you gave advice, mainly butyl caulk, on repairing leaky joints on my rain gutter. But despite careful work, they still leak steadily after every rain. Do you have any more suggestions?
Okay, well, my guess would be, I guess I should further qualify this a little bit. You say they're leaking. Are they leaking at the joints, or are we leaking between the house and the gutter? Is it coming out of the back of the gutter?
Leaking at their own joints.
Well, the caulking should have sealed it because the butyl caulk is a non-hardening or a pliable caulk, so that if it's applied properly to where the joint is no longer open, then we should not be getting water coming out at the cracks. Oftentimes, I have found gutters that are installed over the top of the drip edge instead of behind the drip edge, and so we're actually getting water between the metal drip edge or the fascia and the gutter, and that runs down. I'm going to assume that we're probably working with some older steel gutters.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's possible there's some rust holes and stuff that you're not seeing, but usually if it's a joint problem, then a non-hardening caulk is the correct repair for it.
Any hope for, say, foil or metal patches?
If there is some rusting in there, they do make some adhesive tapes. Actually, there's a metal tape they use a lot for heating ducts that you could probably put in there. But the adhesives really aren't designed to be underwater on a regular basis, so therefore they don't lend themselves to good gutter repair. Usually, if you get a lot of rust in the gutters, it's about time to replace them. If it's not rust, it's just we can't get the joints to seal, then you might try one of the bituminous caulks or bituminous tapes, one of the tar type tapes, self-adhesive type tapes.
Okay, I will. Finally, could you speculate here? My downspouts do not touch the ground, yet my tester lights up when I touch it from the spout to an extension cord plugged into an outlet. Well, where do those spouts get their charge, and could it be dangerous to people touching them?
What kind of test are we using here?
Two-pronged thing that you poke into the slots of the plugs.
Okay, and you're saying you're getting a ground?
I'm getting a light. With one prong in that and the other to the spout.
Well, the downspouts are attached to the house, and I suppose there is a couple places where they could be grounded. So if you're trying to get a positive from your outlet to there, if you're the only way to really truly test it is going to be with a voltmeter and see if we actually have a voltage on the guttering, I would be very surprised. It's not impossible that one of the gutter screws hit a wire someplace when they put things together, but normally there is no wiring anywhere near any of the guttering, so no, there should not be any problem with actually having a current on the gutter. And
okay, it's a ground and not a current, I take it.
My guess is the gutter is working as a ground rather than as a supply, yes.
I still don't see where it reaches ground.
Well, just dirt and water, moisture and everything, just where it touches this, where the house, the siding and everything. The entire house is effectively grounded. Wood does not conduct the electricity as well, so the metal will, but... if there is power to the gutter, obviously the first thing we have to do is figure out where it's coming from. There's people that say you could put a ground strap on it, but I'd much rather figure out where the power is coming from. I doubt that there is, but it's something worth looking into. If you've got something lighting up, it would be a good idea to invest in a voltmeter rather than just a test light and see if we actually do have
one. I have one and didn't think to use it.
So you might want to check that. Put the ground probe on the ground and check it to the... metal downspout itself, and it should read a zero.
Okay. Thanks very much.
All right, and thanks for your call. How much power can actually set off one of those little test devices?
Well, depends on the bulb that's in there. Usually you can get down as low as 12 volts AC or DC.
So something that might not be very strong.
You can get a test light to actually go down farther than that, depending on what it is. Automotive test light, you can usually find 1 or 2 amps.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another call on line one. This one is in Crete in the far south Chicago suburbs. Good morning.
All right. Hi. I was wondering about this new idea, relatively new idea, called leaf guard you can put for the gutters and supposedly guarantee that you're not going to have any leaves or anything else falling in your gutters. I wonder if your man there who has an expert knowledge of homes thought of that.
There are several different types of gutter guards, leaf guards, water protectors. I've seen deflectors that are designed to take a gutter off and just diffuse the water so it doesn't drip straight down. Depending on what you use and how steep the roof is and what kind of trees you've got, a lot of them can help. I won't say they're going to keep the gutters dirt-free permanently. And they do make it much more difficult to clean the gutters once they're installed.
Right.
And there are types that work and there are types that don't. Generally speaking, the screens that go over the top of the gutters work for most things. But if you've got, even some of the maple seeds will go through there, the little whirly gigs that come off the tree will stick in there. And the next thing you know, it holds the seed to end down and you end up with a crop of trees growing out of the gutter.
Okay, thank you very much.
But there's several different types that work, and there are several types that don't, but none of them work permanently. You'll always need to clean at some point in time.
So if you see something that says, never clean your gutters again, no.
Right, yeah. It does make it a little bit more difficult. I've put a couple different ones on my house or on my father's house, and mixed results. If you've got a lot of pine needles, they like to go through most of the small cracks. There's different types of trees that have different types of pollens and such that can block it up. So you'll never keep them clean completely, but the idea is to keep at least some of the bigger debris out so that we're not blocking the downspouts completely.
All right. Well, thanks for your call. And one thing that I've noticed in looking at those, they're expensive.
Depending on the style that you can get, they can get quite expensive. There's anything from a little roll-out expanded plastic piece that you can buy the roll for $3, or you can get them the metal gutter guards that tuck up underneath the shingles and roll out over the edge of the gutter and kind of create
like a little grate.
Almost a pour spout or something. That can be $6, $7 a foot.
That's not so bad.
Well, guttering itself is only about $2 a foot.
It's the installation where it gets expensive. Once again, your phone calls for Scott's Piece are welcome on home maintenance and home repair, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line two right now, a caller in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question that's going to test Scott's diagnostic skills with respect to a Whirlpool dishwasher. last two times I've run this dishwasher, and I do it about once a week, after I've run it and it's gone through all the cycles and I've emptied it and left everything looking fine, about 2 hours later, or maybe three, I've come back to the kitchen and there's a small puddle of water in front of the dishwasher. This has happened in two consecutive times. You have any idea what my problem might be?
Well, if it's a puddle of water after you've run it, most likely what we've got is where the pump drains out. We've got a poor connection or a loose connection someplace, and some of the water is sitting in the drain line. The dishwasher has two lines to it. It has an incoming water line and then an outgoing discharge line. The incoming water line is under pressure at all times, so if we had a leak on it, it would be leaking any time, not just after you've run it. So if it's after you've run it, there's a white or gray, about a half-inch plastic hose that connects to the pump and then goes up to the top of the kitchen sink counter and then back down and either into the tailpipe of the sink or into the disposer, and it kind of forms a little trap. Well, that trap can actually hold just a little bit of water. So my guess is if you were to pull the front cover off the dishwasher, you'll find that you've got a loose clamp on that rubber hose or that plastic hose at the bottom of the dishwasher.
Okay. Do you know how much that would cost to repair?
Well, I don't know. That depends. You know, most of the appliance repair places is $75 to park in the driveway and then another $75 an hour. So it can vary.
Okay. Is it possible that I could fix it myself? Or
Well, I don't want to say the wrong thing, but generally speaking, if you ask that question, you probably need to get somebody to look at it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, sir. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you.
I found in most of those circumstances, it's a matter of confidence. If you think you can do it, well, you might be able to.
One of the fun things I have with doing my inspections is trying to determine the handyman level of the people that I've got from doing my inspection for, is whether or not I tell them, you know, hey, you might want to check repairs on this, or you might want to call somebody depending on their understanding and capabilities. And if you're comfortable with the working end of a screwdriver, then it's always worth taking a look at.
Find the manuals and see what you can do, or or take the easy route.
The only thing I won't recommend is electrical work.
No, that's true.
Generally speaking, I do not tell anybody to do electrical work.
Most definitely. Let's go to a caller this morning on line one in Camargo. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two questions for you. One is about the feasibility of installing heat pumps in this part of the country. Is that practical, and under what circumstances?
Well, okay, heat pump is a fairly broad term. If you're looking at an air-to-air heat pump, it's questionable whether or not they're actually all that effective in this area, depending on what kind of backup system you've got. An air-to-air pump will pull heat out of the air down to about 20 degrees, 25 degrees outside. When we have a temperature drop that goes below that, we get down to our 5 or 10 degrees out, we've got to have some type of backup system. And electricity is relatively expensive, and if you've got a gas one, it can work out fairly well. There are also ground loop or water loop type heat pumps, which they draw the heat out of either the ground or out of a water source, a well or something, and they do not, generally speaking, run out of the warm air source. The problem we run into with a heat pump in cold weather is that a heat pump is known for moving large quantities of warm air rather than small quantities of hot air. So the fan speed has to be up, and they're moving air that is only 10 or 12 degrees different from the air that's in the house. So let's say you're trying to keep the house at, say, 72 degrees. The air coming out of the heat pump may only be 84 or 85 degrees, and 84 or 85 degree air moving, particularly moving fast because we have to move a lot of it, can feel drafty. So particularly when we get into our older years or even very young children, houses with heat pumps in cold weather feel drafty. They don't feel real comfortable. Other than that, I mean, do they work? Yes. I can say that they will work.
They work in this area.
We do have one subdivision on the north side of town where they put in all heat pumps, all electric homes, and they ended up doing a buyback on most of the heat pumps to actually what they had was electric furnaces. They took the electric furnaces out, did a buyback on those, and put in heat pumps to try and make them more efficient. So we do have one whole subdivision on the north side of town that is all heat pump, and it does work, But it's there again, it's not as the perceived comfort of the home can be a little bit less comfortable because it can feel colder in the house.
Okay. Right.
And you had another question?
Yes. This is about replacement windows for a home. Some dealers, or at least one dealer, has indicated that he has triple pane windows. Can you talk about what one should be considering and looking for when doing replacement windows? I see prices advertised from $189 to as much as $1,000 per window. So why the range in price? And what makes it, how would you decide whether or not it is cost-effective to do that, to replace the windows?
Well, that's going to be a tough question because that's kind of on a per-house basis, what kind of windows you've got, what kind of style of windows. Triple-pane windows do have a little bit higher energy savings over a double-pane window. A double-pane window definitely has a higher energy over a single-pane window, depending on what you've got in the house. A lot of these older Victorian homes that we've got here in Champaign-Urbana have such large windows with such character that I almost hate to tell people to put in replacement windows. A good, well-weather-stripped wood window, one that's had some new putty put in it, one that's had some weather stripping done, with a good storm, is about as energy efficient as a standard double pane window. So if you were to get a sealed double glazed window, if you actually spent your time to weather strip some nice windows, some nice original wood windows, you're not going to see a whole lot of energy savings. There'll be a little bit because the weight boxes and stuff like that still leak a little bit of air on the older windows, but for the charm and looks on a lot of these older houses, I don't necessarily recommend replacement windows. Now, if you've got an older wood window that wasn't necessarily a good high-quality window, rather than spend a lot of money reworking it, some of the replacement units, either vinyl-clad wood or the solid vinyl frames, might be the correct answer. As far as the price goes, I'm going to have to stick with the old adage. You pretty much get what you pay for. If you buy the cheapest window out there, you have the cheapest window out there. You don't necessarily need to buy the Cadillac either. You probably don't need to spend thousands of dollars, unless, of course, we're looking at doing a restoration on a 3,000 square foot, 100 year old house at three stories with oak banisters and well done. Then we're going to want a little better quality window in it. But for the average house, one of the medium priced ranged windows is all right. Kind of depends on why you're replacing the ones you've got now. Say, if you've got decent weather stripping on your current wood windows and a good combination storm screen unit, you may not see quite the energy savings they like to tell you you're going to see. They like to give you a lot of information on replacement windows saying, hey, we can save you X amount of percentage of your current heat loss. And, well, they don't know that without going out there to see the house. And not all the heat loss that they're talking about saving is going to be just through the window frame. Glass is glass. It pretty much has about the same amount of energy resistance or energy savings. They do make some coatings which will help reduce some of the UV gains and some of the solar gains. But
what about the gases that they fill the windows with?
Well, the gas itself generally is not a factor on the efficiency of the window. The double pane window, the airspace or the gap between the two panes is your insulator. Air is a good insulator. Matter of fact, fiberglass insulation doesn't insulate. All it does is trap air, which is then the insulator. So your double pane window, the fact that we've got two panes and we've got a dead airspace, which if we filled with air, we could get condensation problems in between the two, so they put in the inert gas. The gas itself is not part of the energy savings. The high-performance windows use a coating on the window to reduce some of the UV and some of the solar gains. It's not necessarily the inert gases between the panes.
Okay, so whether it's argon or I think the other was Krypton, that's... doesn't make much difference.
No, they're just an inert gas so that we've got a moisture-free environment between those windows so we can't get condensation between the panes.
Well, the windows that I'm talking about replacing have moisture in between, indicating that the barrier probably is or sill is broken. So should those be replaced?
Yes, if you've got, well, so you've already got a double pane window if you've got the fogging or the moisture between the panes. So you might want to look into just getting the glass replaced. Unless they're a low-end vinyl frame that's not in very good condition, you don't necessarily need to replace the whole window. There were quite a few windows, particularly the older ones in the mid to late 80s, where we had some problems with the glue that they glued the two panes together with, and they would only last about 6 or 8 years before air or moisture would get in between the two panes, and we'd start getting this fogging effect, and the window would be more translucent than transparent.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've already got a double pane window, then they may be able to just replace the pane of glass itself, depending on how the quality of the window frame.
And just use that new type of glue and create a better seal.
The new panel would have a better seal.
Okay.
Thank you.
And thanks for your call.
Thank you.
How long do today's windows keep that seal? How long are they expected to keep that seal?
Most of the manufacturers are putting anywhere from a 10 to 15-year warranty on the seal on the window. So,
and again, it's what you pay for?
Pretty much.
Let's go to line two before we do it. A reminder, Scott Spies is answering your questions on home maintenance and home repair today. The phone numbers are 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. Outside, 800-222-9455. Now, line two in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning, Scott. And this is from Champaign. I have a question about ductless split air conditioners. I don't see anybody here in town installing those. Do you know where would be a good place to be able to order these systems? This is for all houses where we don't have ducts to put air conditioning. I have seen them in Europe being very popular, but I don't see them around here, the ductless split systems.
Well, I am familiar with those units. And I have actually seen a few of them in the area. I don't know who's doing the installation. That's something that we'd have to try and find for you. Something I could probably do if you were to call us over at the office. The ductless systems are usually, for those of you who aren't real familiar with what you're talking about, it's very similar to what you see at most of the motel units. They have a unit that's got a half of the unit outside and half the unit inside, and it's usually good for heating one area or one room. It's not necessarily a central heating or central cooling system.
They look like room air conditioners.
It's not quite a room air conditioner because they split it off, and so there's a little compressor they mount outside, then they mount a unit on the wall indoors. So it's not quite a through-the-wall or a window-type air conditioner. It's similar, but it is a two-piece unit. Price-wise, because if they only do one area as a general rule, they're good for attic conversions or add-ons to the house where the house is now large enough the initial system doesn't work. As far as trying to condition an entire house where it'd take two or three of these ductless units, you're probably better off using your existing heating and cooling system modifying.
For all houses in which you don't have a duct system, we have hot water radiators, so the air conditioning, there is not a duct system to put air conditioning.
Right. Well, there's a couple ways of actually doing that. Most older homes that have a hot water heat system or a steam system, you can put in some type of air handler in an attic area and at least heat or cool the upper level, and then find an interior closet or some chase where you can run a couple of ducts down to the first floor. In central Illinois, air conditioners actually are more of a dehumidification system than a cooling system. We're trying to take more moisture out of the house. While they do cool the house, it's actually pulling moisture out. So a unit cooling the upper levels will actually make the first level quite comfortable because it'll take the humidity out of the house, so at least the house is good and dry. And also the cool air from the upper floors will flow down to the second floors. So you've got a couple options. The ductless systems, the only thing I'm thinking on, you're talking about an older house, so it's most older homes, they don't have large open areas. They have multiple different small rooms. I like to refer to them as being compartmentalized. And the ductless systems work well for each individual room, but you'd have to have such a great number of them to really be effective in the rest of the house that we could probably come up with another system that would work better.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you for your call. So your recommendation would be if somebody has, just the radiators, You know, how effectively do you do air conditioning? Is room air conditioners or nothing? Or
No, it's actually done quite often. I see it on a regular basis where we have an attic mount air handler,
right.
A compressor outside. We run the ductwork through the attic and put ceiling diffusers. The ideal position for an air conditioning duct is the center of the room at the ceiling mm-hmm. to let the cool air drop. The ideal location for a heat register is at the floor in front of the cold air source for the room, which is generally the window. So heating and cooling do not like to have the air put in at the exact same place.
Right.
So having a hot water system where you have your baseboard or you have your radiators around the outside perimeter walls and having a separate duct system in the attic for air conditioning is actually the ideal or the most efficient way of doing it.
Even in a two-floor house, or you wouldn't be able to put ducts in the ceiling on the first floor.
Well, most of the time you can get fairly creative about it and you put all your ductwork in the attic, but there's usually a closet on the upper level that we can take a 10 by 10 corner out of the closet and run a duct from the attic down through the closet and come out in a ceiling level someplace on the first floor.
Hmm.
Most of the older homes with hot water heat have large stairways to the second floor. So you put cold air upstairs, it's going to cascade right down that stairwell to the first floor. Yes, if you've got a converted porch or a converted garage or something on that older home, then an extra air conditioner for that particular one level space may be more of a viable alternative. But as far as for the whole house, usually it can be done from the attic.
All right. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 for questions on home maintenance for Scott Spies. We go to line 4 now and a caller in Cumberland County. Good morning.
Hi. I have a question concerning my crawl space. I have an older farmhouse, and I have, of course, vents into the crawl space on three sides of the house. And I'd always close those up in the winter, and I read somewhere that can contribute to, like, heaving and cracking the walls and that I should leave them open. And so I just was curious if I should close them or open them.
In my opinion, they should be closed. Matter of fact, I feel that they probably should be closed in the wintertime and in the summertime.
Really?
The only time you really need the ventilation in a properly sealed crawl space is going to be if there's humidity or moisture in there, and generally speaking, that is going to be spring and fall. A good proper vapor barrier over the soil surface should help reduce the humidity levels in the crawl space, so you wouldn't necessarily need to have it open year-round. If you've got air conditioning ducts in the crawl space, and most homes that use the heating system as also the cooling system, you do have your ductwork run through that crawl space. Well, you've got a cold air running through your metal ductwork in the crawl space, and we let warm summer air in through the crawl space vents. The next thing you know, we end up with condensation on the ducts in the crawl space. The condensation drips down onto the vapor barrier, then evaporates and comes up into the house, and you end up using the air conditioner to take the moisture that you let in through the crawl space vent.
Okay.
So if the crawl space is wet, then yes, we need to have it ventilated. But what we need to do is work on drying the crawl space out. If the crawl space is relatively dry, you've got good grating around the outside to drain the surface water away, you've got a good vapor barrier over the top of the soil surface, then we shouldn't need to open those vents.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. And by vapor barrier, explain what that is and how you do it.
Sheet of plastic, something that prevents water from moving through it.
Does it have to be sealed up to the foundation or whatever?
I usually like to lap the vapor barrier up the wall about 2 to 3 inches and 6 to 8 inches of overlap in between places. Also a crawl space. Because the crawl space walls are in contact with the exterior soil, the walls can get cool. So it's not a bad idea to insulate the crawl space walls and the band joist. I get in a lot of crawl spaces where somebody has insulated the floors from the crawl space. We had cold air in the crawl space. We put the insulation in the floorboards. Well, generally speaking, the soil in the crawl space will stay about 55 degrees pretty much year-round as long as it does not have a cold air source. So if we close the vents in the wintertime and we insulate the perimeter walls in the band joist area, that crawl space should stay a minimum of 50 to 55 degrees. Now, if you've got any heat ducts running through the crawl space, a little bit of air loss through the heat ducts, it warms that crawl space area, warm air rises. So we have a semi-heated portion of the house, and hot air rising up actually warms the floors. So a good dry crawl space with a good vapor barrier, well-insulated walls, should actually make the floors warmer on the first floor.
And as far as ventilation goes, you're saying then that it's probably a good thing to you know, open and shut the vents spring and fall?
If there's moisture or something, we need to move out of there. Mm-hmm. If the crawl space has got a good vapor barrier and is dry, the crawl space vents really shouldn't be needed. There's actually a few houses, I'm going to say a few because I've only found three, in Champaign-Urbana that actually are using the crawl space as the plenum for the furnace. They actually take the furnace and drop it over the top of a hole and then blow all the hot heated air down into the crawl space. Hmm. Now, the crawl space is super insulated and has a complete vapor barrier. We're talking running from the sill plate all the way around. And when you need heat in a room, basically you just cut a hole in the floor and put a register, and we're just pressurizing the crawl space. So something like that, obviously no ventilation to the outside. Mm-hmm. So if you've got the crawl space dry, you should not need to ventilate it to the outside. Now, if there's some humidity, some moisture, things like that, you know, you've got a little bit of water gets on top of the plastic, or if you don't have plastic covering all the dirt, then, yeah, when we have our spring and our summer, our spring and our fall storms, it's not a bad idea to get some ventilation and get that air moving through there.
I know in my situation, I am using that as the ducts underneath for air conditioning. Mm-hmm. So would I just assume that in the summer that we're going to have a heat differential and a little condensation going on?
Right, whereas if you were to close off those crawl space vents and not let the humidity in from the outdoors,
you'd still keep it cool enough.
It would still keep
that.
Well, the air conditioner is taking moisture out of the house, mm-hmm. and anytime you reduce the moisture in one area of the house, vapor pressure will try and equalize. So it's actually going to draw any high humidity throughout the rest of the house to that low vapor pressure point, which means you're actually drying out your crawl space by running your air conditioner, by letting the cool, humid air, or the warm, humid air from outside back into the crawl space. You're bringing more moisture back into the house.
Right.
So as long as we don't have water coming through the foundation walls or a wet crawl space, yeah, I'd say close the vents in the summertime.
All right. Let's go to line four on a cell phone. Good morning. Line four. Good morning. You're on with Scott Spies. No, apparently not. Nope. He's taken off. That's something that, I mean, nobody thinks about crawl spaces. In fact, I think I checked underneath my crawl space, and apparently somebody just started storing things underneath, which you say is probably not a good idea anyway.
The crawl space being a cooler portion of the house, like say earlier, 55 degrees roughly, is also going to be one of the early points for any moisture condensation. Once you have moisture in the house, any place where there's the cold spot is where we can start getting condensation once the humidity level gets too high. So storing things in a crawl space usually does result in them at least occasionally getting damp or humid. So if you're going to put something down there, it needs to be pretty well sealed up. I've seen a lot of storage done in crawl spaces, usually in some of these Tupperware-type big boxes, storage boxes, where you can seal them up and keep things dry. And it does work well.
As long as you don't mess with the vapor barrier.
As long as you're not putting holes or something into the vapor barrier or damaging the vapor barrier. So from that standpoint, the crawl space can be used as a storage area. I've been in some that were carpeted, so it was nice and easy on your knees. Of course, the problem with that is if you ever got moisture down there, that moisture would sit in that carpet and create a mold and mildew problem. So as long as you have a perfectly dry crawl space, that could be done.
Otherwise, you'd have a smell that would never go away.
That is correct, yes. So,
how many is that common to see a lot of people using crawl spaces for storage? Or
usually not, because most crawl spaces are just not all that accessible.
No.
We get some of them that are accessible from basement areas. They're more likely to be used for a storage area. Smaller houses that just don't have storage spaces, more likely to use any place that they can. But as a general rule, I find a little bit of old construction debris down there. Occasionally an old Starbucks cup or a Dunkin' Donuts coffee cup from somebody doing some work down there. But no, don't find a whole lot of stored items down there.
And when you worry about that, you know, keeping it more dry, you have to worry about the access point being tight as well as not having any ventilation. So.
Well, most of the time the accesses are into the living area of the house or into the garage, so it's not usually a big issue. If it is an outdoor access, then yes, we will want an insulated cover or a sealed cover from the outside as well.
All right. Let's go to line one. Your questions for Scott Spies and home maintenance. Line one in Urbana. Good morning.
Hello. I just tuned into the show a couple minutes ago, so you may have already dealt with the question I'm going to ask. We had a lot of water in our basement after the big rains of a week or two ago, and the crawl space was wet. We had actually about 25 to 30 inches of water in our basement.
Wow.
We still... The water is all out of there now, and it's the walls seem to be fairly dry in the basement, but there's still a musty smell in the house. Should we have the duct work cleaned to get rid of that?
I would say the musty smell probably is not in the duct work. After a lot of moisture like that, everything in the house is wet. You want to keep fans running. You want to keep dehumidifiers running. It can take a week or two to really dry things out. You've got to get that humidity out of the house so we don't have mold and mildew issues all throughout the house. Moisture in the basement will actually create a water problem in the attic. So we really need to – the musty smell is relatively common after a flooding. Matter of fact, we've got that problem with my father's house right now. We've got so much clay in our soil here that our water just didn't percolate down through it very well. So we ended up with some perched water tables and a lot of moisture in a lot of basements in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So the ducts, you might search on the internet on duct cleaning. As a general rule, it's one of those things that can help in certain situations, but it's not a blanket fix-all type situation.
Yeah.
I doubt that your humidity level in the house has actually affected the ducts unless we got water actually up into the ducts and we got some sediment or something in there.
I doubt that happened. Now, our furnace, of course, was damaged, so we have not had air conditioning. We have actually two air conditioners for two different parts of our house, and one is outdoors, so that one's not affected. That's been working, but the main air conditioner, which is in our basement, has not been working now. We think we're going to get it repaired today, so it should start working. Will that help to dehumidify the house once that's operating?
Quite a bit, yes. That will be your major dehumidification of the house. A power dehumidifier will work, but it doesn't move anywhere near as much air as what the air conditioner does.
Sure.
So, an air conditioner on a hot, humid day, just from normal air coming in from outside, can take 3 to 5 gallons of water a day out of the house. When you've had a house that's had as much moisture as what you've got, you could take 5 to 8 gallons a day out of that the air conditioning system. So, yes, that is definitely the best dehumidification you can do to the house is get the air conditioners back up and running.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were also told that there was at least a possibility. We've had kind of conflicting opinions on this from the service people that have come out, that we may be getting water seeping in through our foundation. Is there any way, number one, we can know if that's actually true, and number two, if it is true, what you might suggest, what kind of person we should turn to do something about it?
Well, first we need to figure out where the water was coming in from. I don't know, you say 25 inches. Usually that is what I'll call the perched water table, where we actually have the clay layer has so much moisture on top of it that we end up with the water levels raising up above the basement floor level, which actually hasn't happened in Champaign-Urbana in about the last 25 years for most areas. But we've had houses that haven't had water in 25 years that are suddenly 3 and 4 inches below water table, perched water table. If you call the Illinois Geological Survey, I think they'll tell you the actual water table at Champaign-Urbana right now is down about 4 inches, which with all this rain is hard to believe. But
yeah.
The water hasn't soaked down to the actual water table yet because we're still on all these clay layers, all these perched water tables. Look for areas where the water has come through the foundation. To determine whether it came through the foundation or through the floor, you have to look on the walls. If it looks like there's, particularly in the corners where downspouts are, kind of diagonal lines or shade marks on the walls, and usually it's an indication that water came in from the surface. If the walls look clean and all the water came up through out of the floor, then usually it's just this perch water table. But
yeah,
without coming out there and taking a look at it, that you know, you need somebody with a kind of a trained eye. Most inspectors are fairly familiar with water systems or water problems, so most people could take a look at it. Of course, it's something. One of the services that we do offer is a maintenance inspection for things like that.
Right. And just one more thing quickly. When I tuned in, you were saying that vents in crawl spaces could be closed during the summer. A carpenter who came out told us very emphatically that we should leave the vents in our crawl space open, that it would be could be damaging to close them. Was he just mistaken, or is there a difference of opinion?
Well, it's a difference of the condition of the house. If you've got moisture down there, then yes, we do need to leave them open.
Right.
If the crawl space is dry, no, we do not need to leave it open.
Yeah.
So there's no one blanket answer. It all depends on the individual crawl space.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, well, that's very helpful. Thanks very much.
All right, well, thank you very much.
And thank you for your call. I think we've retrieved our cell phone caller. Hopefully it's either the same person or somebody new on line four. Good morning, line four.
Hello?
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 You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I live in a ranch-style house. We've been there for 30 years, and we've never had our vents and our ductwork cleaned, and I don't even know how to go about doing that. But I would like to have it done because I have a lot of allergies. What would be the best way to do that?
Well, allergies is one of the things that might possibly be helped by cleaning the ductwork. Most of the heating and cooling companies, or there are several heating and cooling companies here locally that have the duct cleaning service. Actually, for allergies, I like to recommend better filters. Once the dust and dirt is in the duct system, it usually doesn't move through it. The duct system usually doesn't have enough velocity to clean itself. In other words, if air's moving through there, the dust isn't sitting. If the dust does sit and collect, then there's not enough change in air pressure to dislodge it and cause it to blow through the house. So all a duct system is doing is pulling it in from one side of the house and blowing it out the other. A good filter will take out most of it. Now, if it's something where we've had somebody that like to sweep things into the duct system, which I've actually seen on some new construction, or we've had some water in the system, then, yeah, it's not a bad idea to have the ducts cleaned. And if you say you have some allergies, then they can do some cleaning and they can actually spray in some chemicals in there to help reduce some of the allergens and stuff that are in the ductwork. I would check with your heating and cooling company and see if they offer the service. That'd be the first place to start.
Okay.
All right.
And how would I know what would be the right filters to put on?
There's so many different types of filters. You can do anything from cheap paper filters, which take out about 14% of the particulates, up to high-performance paper filters, which are a box-style filter, which will usually take up to 75 or 80% of the particulates. You can get electronic filters, which may take up as much as 85 or 90% of the particulates. Could even take some smoke or grass pollens out. It all kind of depends on what you want to do. I generally don't like to see somebody put in the really cheap filters. The $79 ones don't do a whole lot, or 79 cent ones rather. The 79 cent ones you pick up at the grocery store usually don't do a whole lot. Most of the time, the electronic ones aren't really needed unless you really have a lot of problems. There's some different allergen type filters, more of a mesh or a paper. Even a cloth-type filter will pull out more particulates, more pollens and such. The problem with air filters is the better the filter, the less air we move through it. The less air we move through it, the more or less efficient the heating and cooling system is. A good air filter is sort of like a good piece of cheese. The older it gets, the better it gets until it gets so old, so good that you end up having to throw it away. Once it gets really moldy, you got to throw the cheese away. Well, once the better your air filter is, the faster it will block up, so the more often you have to change it because less stuff gets through it. It blocks more. An inexpensive air filter doesn't block anywhere near as much because more stuff goes through it. So I like to recommend usually the $5 to $10 filters and change them about every 2 months, and that will usually help. But if you've got a lot of allergies, you may want to consider moving up to one of the box filters that you'd only have to change every 6 to 8 months or even a year, depending on the house. But they're about $40 or $50 to get somebody to come out and change one.
Oh, okay. Well, frankly, it would be worth $40 or $50 to breathe better. So thank you. I appreciate your help.
All right. In that case, I would probably recommend one of the high-performance box-type filters, which actually takes a special filter box in the system, so you have to call your heating and cooling guy to come out and make an adjustment to your system to be able to fit one of those in.
All right. Thanks for your call. Let's go on to line number two in Rantoul. Good morning. You're on the air with Scott Spies.
Good morning. This is just an opinion question. If you were building a new home these days, say 2,000 square foot ranch, with heating and cooling costs being what they are and fuel prices keep going up, what heating and cooling system would you put in a new house if you were building it?
Well, right now I would have to say that I would probably go with a standard HVAC system, just a forced air gas type system for this particular climate. The energy savings is going to be more in the how well you seal the house, how well you insulate the ceilings, how well you insulate walls, what type of windows you put in it. You can do a lot with orientation of the house, which way do my glass panels face or don't face, if there are any trees, where you plant trees. So a lot of your energy savings comes in heat loss, not necessarily in heat source. You could heat a house with a candle if you had it insulated enough that none of the heat could get out of it. Unfortunately, we don't have those building capabilities at the moment, and we really don't want to live inside of a plastic bag. Mm-hmm. For cost efficiency, from what I've seen, I would probably stick with a standard forced air or natural gas type system. Now, if you're out someplace where you have to get propane or something like that, then you might want to consider one of the heat pumps or geothermals. But once you get into those, they tend to get a little bit more expensive on the initial cost. So, of course, the more you put into the money building it, then the more it takes to recover the initial cost. So it's kind of a hit and miss of whether or not you're actually saving as much energy as what you think you are.
Okay, so what you're telling me is, if I got a choice, spend the money on the insulation and sealing the house, and spend less money on the heating and cooling, and I'll save the money back. It's better spent on insulation than it is on, say, a geothermal system.
Well, the geothermal systems work really well, and that if it's outside of town, then that's probably one of the things I would probably go with. Because it's just not as easy to get natural gas out there. But if you're in an area with natural gas, even though we do have prices going up, I haven't seen anything that would indicate to me that the price has gone up enough to where we need to start spending an extra $6,000 or $7,000. It's going to be a long time to recover that.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. We've got a few more minutes left. We'll get one call, maybe two more calls. Line 3 in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. I've got an older home. It's a two-story. It's on a slab, and it has virtually no attic, and it has hot water heat, hot water radiator. So we've resorted to window air conditioning units. And I thought I saw something somewhere in a magazine or on television about a system that has a compressor that sits outside and feeds some air handling units that you can then mount inside. Can you tell me anything about that type of system for a situation where you have no ductwork and you have no opportunity to get into the crawl space or the attic because there isn't any?
Well, I'm not real familiar with that. I mean, there's a lot of very specialized heating and cooling systems out there. If you have no way of getting to an attic or a crawl space, then yes, something like that would probably work well, or one of these split systems. They're not real common in this area, so your big downfall is A, finding somebody to put it in, and B, finding somebody to service it once you have it in place.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I like to try and go with the more conventional installations, because we can find somebody to do some work.
Right. Well, we just have no opportunity for a conventional system. So
yeah, if you've got a flat roof house on a concrete slab, then yes, you've got to come up with some different alternatives.
Right, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call. One more call in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Hi. We recently had a sump pump failure, and, you know, in fairness, the pump had been working fine for 20-some years that we know of, at least. And when we had the new one put in, I was dismayed to find out the guarantee is only about a year and a half on the pump. Do you recommend any particular, routine replacement interval, or also backup systems? The plumber said battery backups only work for a few hours, so if you're gone very long, it's not going to help so much. For, I believe, around $500, you could do some kind of a water pressure backup. What is your thought on this stuff?
All right. Well, as far as sump pumps go, first of all, a sump pump in most cases is a solution to a symptom, not a solution to a problem. If you've got water coming in, the problem isn't how do I pump it out. The problem is how do I keep it from getting here. So if you've done what you can around the outside to reduce it and you still have water and you need to have the pump, that's where we're at. Yes, most of the newer pumps are being sold in the big box stores and are being sold by how cheap they can make them. So they're not putting a big warranty on them. So a backup system, if your basement requires a system, in other words, you can't keep water away and it does run every time it rains, then a backup system is a very good idea. You can put in a secondary electric pump, so you mount one higher than the other one. Then if you've got a power outage, of course, neither pump works. So the water-powered backup system would be my next choice. The water-powered backup systems do not move the quantity that an electric pump does. So if it's one of these things where you've got a lot of water coming in, the water backup may help, but it may not keep you completely dry. The battery backup system, as your guy indicated, they do wear out batteries. And basically, the batteries are good for 2 years, and most people don't find out the battery is bad until they actually need it. So the backup system rarely works when it's really needed.
Out of mind, right?
Yeah. So I do like the water backup systems for that particular reason.
Okay. Right. But you wouldn't necessarily recommend routinely replacing the pump in it? Every so many years,
really the pumps, it depends. A pump that gets used a lot tends to work a lot. You get a lot more life out of it. They don't necessarily wear out. Usually inactivity, usually a little corrosion and stuff prevents them from working. So one that only works occasionally may have more replacement than one that has to work almost continuously. So, yeah, there's no given formula that I can say, hey, that pump's going to go bad every 2 years.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. And I would assume that you may want to, like, turn it on briefly every once in a while just to make sure it's working.
If you've got a system that doesn't run all that often, then it's not a bad idea to do a quick check on it. There's also varying grades of pumps that you can buy. You can buy the $90 pump, or you can actually get some of the sewage ejection pumps, which are a little cast iron frame, a little bit heavier for $200. All depends on what you want to put in there.
All right. It's been a good hour. Thanks for joining us again this month, Scott.
Oh, thank you for being here and all the callers for calling in today.
All right, and thanks to the callers for me as well. Scott Spies is a home inspector with Spies Home Inspection here in Champaign-Urbana, and he joins us on a regular basis to ask questions or answer questions about home maintenance and home repair.